Okay, so we have Peter and Adam on the ends of the table from oncology. We have Dwayne in the middle, who talked about CCTS earlier, and Ron Schultz, who talked about UDEP earlier. And I'm going to hit that, which should make that should unmute the people we have on the phone. So, folks on the phone, you should be able to ask questions now. Those of us who are spread around the room, if you have a question, you are probably going to have to shout it for the people on the phone to even have the remotest possibility of hearing it. So it might be a good idea for people responding to somehow cue in what the question was as you do that. Okay? So we're now open, and you can certainly feel free to ask questions of each other. Folks, you've been sitting on questions all the time.
I have a question here. I'm maybe confused about what you said. You have to, accommodate CCT by adding this concept of file name to your ontological system. You know, to me, isn't that file name a two different concepts? I mean, there's a file, there's a name, and should be in a different position in your ontological tree. Well, I don't understand what do you mean by you have to add.
Okay, so that's a good question. It actually brings out the issue of relations versus classes. So you're actually talking, I think, about two things. A file, an object, an instance, a particular instance, has a relationship, file name, to a string of characters, which is the file name. Okay, so there are, well, I guess, really three things here. There's two objects and a relation. Okay, and so we already had the notion of in Sumo, symbolic string to handle the file name. We already had the notion of computer file, and we had the notion names, a very generic relationship between a thing and the name it carries. So, you know, we have names, the object, Adam, and the string, ADAM. But we didn't have specifically file name, so the notion that this is a name that is specifically held or kept in file system about relating a file to its string of characters that is the identifier for that file. That was what we had to add.
I would assert that it's deeper than that, too, because the file name also has a relationship to the person using it. If it's the computer using it, it's a machine bytecode representation of that name. It's different than the name you might present to somebody in a localized language.
Well, that at least in our domain here, is a difference, I guess, in terminology, okay? So yeah. The computer has, you know, what it would call a file name, and the person has, as a separate agent, has what it would call a file name. But in fact, the concept of the relationship between a file and its string of human-supplied characters, that is what the file name is. And we may well create a different relation that may have a different English label on it, which is really coincidental. It carries no real information. It's just a convenient identifier for human understanding. And we may call that, you know, computer name. But those two concepts exist, and you're right that they are distinct.
I've been asked to respond to that.
Could you restate that, please? I couldn't hear it.
About to. Yeah, the question was, okay, what's the big picture here? For example, how might this relate to something like UBL? I'm going to take UBL in this case as an example of many similar projects, okay? The basic problem to be solved is here I have one syntax, and here I have a different syntax. Are they saying the same thing? Okay, that's really what it boils down to. So, for example, our XREF project here in EIDX is about forming a matrix and trying to slog through the question of, you know, here is an X12 version of a set of elements in a purchase order. Here is a RosettaNet. Here is a CBL. Here are what we think are the equivalents. Okay, so in an 850, you've got this term. In CBL, you've got this term. In RosettaNet, you've got this term. And it's our finding as business experts that these, in fact, express the same concept, right? But there are some complications. One of the complications, which actually I'll probably rephrase as a question when I get to it, is what do we do about things where they almost match but not quite? Like they don't, they're saying pretty much the same thing but not exactly. That's a big problem. And another is simply where's the grounding here? And there are various we've been presented implicitly in these presentations with various ways to ground things. So I'm kind of a simpleton about all this. I'm kind of where you are with this. I'm listening to these things. I'm going, okay, I sort of understand what's going on here. I'm still stuck back at the level where here I have a term, here I have an English definition. Here I have another term. Does it mean the same thing? Well, I'm going to find out by seeing if I can find its definition and then comparing the definition. All right. Another way is to say, well, these live in taxonomies of meaning, can I compare at that level? Can I say they live in the same place in some taxonomy, therefore they must mean the same thing? Or I might find out if I'm looking at it taxonomically, oh, this is pretty much in the same neighborhood, but it's a subclass of this other thing. It's not identical to it. It's a special instance of it. And then we have, with ontologies, we're getting to the point where we can actually have rules associated with these things. But to me, I'm just starting to try and figure this out myself. So I'm the wrong person to ask about that. But the basic problem is trying to establish whether something expressed in one set of in one syntax is equivalent to the other thing. That's the most basic problem, because people are trying to implement things like adapters and translators. Okay, and The biggest problem is how do we get that equivalence? But other, please, the panelists.
Yeah. So when it would, to answer your question, I would phrase the relationship as, you know, the question that John and others have posed is the seemingly simple one at first. It's analyzing something and figuring out the meaning of it. And the presentations you've heard from us are kind of a byproduct of a realization. When we looked at that question, we realized that the underlying mechanisms that determine that aren't as obvious or as simple as they first appear. There's actually a very large degree of complexity surrounding it. Any one thing and try to get general consensus on it and everyone sees it the same way, there's always going to be some ambiguity. Even within using the same word in the English language, let's go buy some stock. And we're on Wall Street in New York, we're going to do one thing. If we're at a cattle ranch in Missouri, we're going to do something else. So it's a very complex problem, and these are kind of, I think there's a lot of really good research that was presented by these guys, and it's all going to somehow fit in as part of the solution. None of us are probably sure, or would be arrogant if we assumed we knew what the total answer was for the holy grail of solving this.
This is Leo Obers. Could I comment on that?
Please.
Yeah. One of the issues is that you can't relate different syntaxes according to their meaning unless you specify the meaning. So now, currently, you're using basically data dictionaries, two human strings, right? Two human definitions to define your constructs. And then you try to correlate those two definitions basically with a human in the loop, right, saying, oh, these are the same definitions. Well, what ontologies are trying to provide is a logical representation of the meaning of both of those sides, right, so that a machine could, in fact, correlate those kind of in at least a semi-automated fashion. So the issue is you can't provide the meaning, you can't provide mappings between syntaxes unless you know the mappings between the semantics of those syntaxes.
And even that is just the beginning of it, because you cannot define the semantics of one single thing, because when that thing gets used in a different set of circumstances, it actually changes the semantics of it. And I think that's all part of that framework.
Yes, right. No, I agree. And that's typically called pragmatics, on the semantic pragmatics spectrum. And what that means is that you have to define the semantics within context based upon the use and intent of that semantics. So it changes from one context to another, but that's part of really the extended semantics of that.
At least we agreed on what to call it, right. The problem.
I'd like to take another pass at that, and hopefully it's consistent with everything everyone said. Am I loud enough on the phone?
Just about, yeah.
Yeah, it's even louder. Things coming to me, and I'll hold it still. To take it out of kind of the mechanics of what's going on, I think the big picture issue to a large degree has to do with how do we judge the quality of a data standard? Ideally, how do we find quality standards for data standards? And what committees tend to do is, by their nature, take the approach of consensus. If we reach consensus, that is in and of itself a measure of quality.
Right.
But that still leaves open the question of, is it correct from an objective standpoint? And how are we going to define correctness in a more objective fashion than just consensus? And that's where you get in the idea of semantic modeling and conceptual modeling, almost as a grounding of correctness that can be used then to judge whether or not these data models are likely to have stability long term.
Yeah, so one of the other things that I think we maybe should address then is, you know, we're talking about starting with some informal or semi-formal source documents. And so, you know, yes, there's going to be this problem of different words being used to mean different things. And linguistically, some of that is disambiguated as a result of context. But I think what, at least my work, I'm trying to get away from, in a way, is language and the problem of context. By not having the terms be dependent on the context, but rather defining terms independent of context that then maybe can be linked to an independent and or a contextually dependent word.
Yes.
And if I can amplify on what you just said, that's where I would also make the argument that those objects, those fundamental objects in UDEF and those fundamental properties of UDEF are contextually independent, because an enterprise and a product and a person, you know, those are fundamental objects that I hope nearly everybody on the planet has in their mind in general what those basic objects are. Your example of code and identifier, offline I can explain how I teach that, but in a nutshell, an identifier is something that you cannot possibly have the complete list because it is continually growing. Like a Social Security number is an identifier for a person, and there's no way in the world that you could have a list of all valid values unless you were the Social Security Administration. And even then, you may not ever have a completely up-to-date list. So an identifier is a continuous, in other words, there's a time dimension that separates identifier from code. A code is something that, it's like a lookup table where you have all possible values, all valid values. And that would be a code.
So that sounds good. So that sounds like something I could actually code up in Axiom. So one of the, I think then the advantage of the ontology approach is that then we're not dependent upon an English speaker may find that unambiguous, but rather that we've created a formal term which then can be in turn translated to other non-English languages. So for example, you know, for Sumo, we have translations that are available in Czech, Italian, German, Hindi, Chinese, and Tagalog. And these translations are generated now automatically from the axioms. So somebody who is a native Chinese speaker who doesn't speak English can still use Sumo because the terms in Sumo are not in any way dependent upon an understanding of English syntax or grammar or vocabulary.
Mm-hmm.
It's strictly dependent upon one's understanding of, you know, these Chinese labels then on terms which are really defined in first-order logic.
This is Steve Ray. Could I make a comment real quick? I was hearing, I presume that was Ron, talking about the UDEF in terms like enterprise and person, right?
Yes.
I was just wondering the sort of the intersection between the UDEF work and the SUMO work, is I was presuming that how those could blend would be where you would, in fact, axiomatize some of those terms like enterprise and person, because I guess I don't really see those as atomic-based things. Those themselves, I think, are subject to a certain amount of interpretation. Right. Is that how you both, maybe, I don't know, Adam and Ron see it, or...?
I believe that the concept of an enterprise, when you look at the definition of enterprise versus person,
uh-huh.
granted you can have, you know, it's a legal entity of some nature. In other words, it's got one or more persons in it, but it's something that's a legal entity.
But when you say, when you look at the definition of enterprise, are you talking about an English text definition?
No, I'm talking about the way it's defined according to UDEF.
And how is that expressed?
It's the only definitions that are in UDEF are for those basic 16 objects as well as the 18 properties,
mm-hmm.
and then everything else underneath the UDEF, which is its taxonomy, is based on what I'd call the experts in that field. For instance, much of UDEF was built on the configuration management experts. You know, in the U.S., being involved in basically helping build that portion of the UDEF taxonomy,
mm-hmm.
and so it's the, you know, the best practice, the best terminology, if you will, but then following the rules for UDEF. So it's, you know, and then as it then was used to analyze and map things in the procurement world, so purchase orders and invoices and such, those terms. You know, it was an analysis of what did X12 call it, what did XCBL call it, what did OAGIS call it,
mm-hmm.
and then what kind of common terminology, you know, could accurately, completely describe that concept. So it's taking the experts in the field and using the terminology that's used most commonly, and then applying it with the rules of UDEF to come up with that, if you will, taxonomy.
But Steve, I mean, I think fundamentally, though you're right. I mean, I think you're both right here. I think, Steve, what you're recommending is that taking that best terminology that's been defined in all these different communities and has already been related, that to now take the definition of the concept that lies behind that terminology and express it formally in logical axioms, hopefully with respect to SUMO.
Yeah.
That would be a positive thing.
I think so, too.
Yeah, the issue is, that typically these taxonomies are built with in terms of terminology as opposed to concepts, right? So there has to be a translation that has to be undergone then, because the terminologies are what the experts actually use in the field, but the model, the semantics that's behind that is probably not the same thing as that taxonomic tree.
Well, it's carried around in the heads of those experts, and that's, I think, the challenge that we're facing is trying to make as much of that explicit as possible.
Which is what the UDEF tries to do.
Mm-hmm.
Is the UDEF...
Sorry, Leo, we have a question from the back. So.
Sure.
Distribute the microphones. Right, it won't. Why don't we leave them on? A pause while our speaker comes forward.
Oh, okay. Separate from there. Okay. So my question comes as total ignorance. I am sitting in on here because I am interested in the philosophy and where the direction is coming from. I have, within my company, a proposal that in order to resolve some of the issues of trying to deal with the fact that we support multiple industry formats and have, unfortunately, many SAP instances plus other back-ends in the company that are using their own versions of everything as well, that we have not just a many-to-one, we have a many-to-many kind of situations of translation. And the proposal is that we come up with some kind of canonical model to try and separate ourselves from the back-end issues of doing their own thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm listening to your discussions and thinking, would this help me to achieve my canonical model? And what I'm hearing sounds like a lot of nouns and adjectives with classes with their adjectives as qualifiers, and the properties are not a lot of nouns and adjectives, and I'm saying, okay, so where are the verbs? And I'm also saying, I know I have a lot of conditions. I think Sumo might be getting towards verbs. What about the conditions? And I'm going to give you a precise real-life example, because we need to get back from the theory down to real life. How do we use this? I, in my company, have distanced ourselves from these different industry formats, if I am trying to get back to the subject here of standards, by saying that we've developed a business content for messaging for our particular company use, and that we will then map that to every one of the industry formats that we support. So beginning conceptually to this idea of a canonical format, but obviously it doesn't have a real-life thing that I can put it in the computer to use. Okay, I have a specific instance in a shipment notification, okay, back down to real life here. We all know that shipment notification is a very common used message through all of the businesses in many different contexts. And we know that a lot of the time, one shipment equals one order. But we also know we have several instances where we have one shipment equals multiple orders. We're well in the XML format that we have a lot of people complaining they don't want to use XML because they have to carry the overhead of all the extra tags. So, in the instance if we have one shipment and one order, or at least all going to the same particular business party, that we would like to put that up at the header once and once only. But we want to accommodate those issues where if we have multiple orders or where they are going to multiple sold to parties, maybe obviously single ship to, but multiple sold to parties, that we could have an override at our detail level to be able to accommodate those in that instance. And to even go to the issue of saying most of them are going to the same place, so we will put it in the header and only override it at the detail. Now this is what I call conditional, and it's very specific, and I'm saying how would an ontology be able to resolve this if I'm going after a canonical model?
So, all three of us are going to respond here. May I respond, especially the last one, because I mean,
I'll take the one about process.
Yeah, I mean, so I mean, sumo has nouns, verbs, adjectives, or the things that linguistically would correspond to nouns, verbs, adjectives, properties, modals, you know, conditionals, all the things that you're looking for are in there. In sumo alone, there's an ontology of 175 different process types. The domain ontologies extend that considerably. Process types can have various properties attached to them that talk about manner. And the first order logical rules are the things that you're looking for in the conditionals. So we can say, if the following things are true, then these other things follow. And that's a fundamental aspect of having something that's more expressive than a taxonomy, that we have the ability to express these conditionals, not as procedures, not as in if-then in some Java code or C++ code or a stored procedure in an SAP script, but rather we have an ability to express them declaratively, have them chosen in the cases where they express and apply dynamically.
And those conditionals could actually be expressed in terms of an implementation then.
Yeah, just from an architectural perspective, a lot of, but not all of what we're talking about here, is to deal with the actual data model of the architecture, the data model view of the architecture. So when you're looking at the whole architecture of how, you know, you talk to another company, you have a collaborative view of this where we agree we're going to do this, and then you have below that a process view, which is here's the business process and the sequence of events that happen in that. In those sequence of events, you have, you know, data being transferred from one place to another, instance data. The UBL, DCTS work, and to a large degree the UDEF work is largely focused on just the data model aspect of that whole question. So there is the implications of the business process that do affect what we're doing here, but we're not addressing it specifically in that work. So UBL has, for instance, the order process. They've defined the information models that slot into what that step of the order is. And that's kind of where we're coming from on it. I can't speak about the ontological because it has a lot more expanded notion of concept in it than just the core CCTS work.
And I would also echo what Duane just said, that the semantics of the payload is different than the syntax of the XML schema, which is where all your business rules for your process will show up. So the fact that you want to allow for a single order to be associated to a given carrier's advanced ship notice, that's again part of the schema, or to allow for multiple orders to be part of that.
It
doesn't have to be. But it's those business rules are captured within the rules of the syntax and how and the order and what's mandatory and optional of your syntax of the schema. The content, the payload, is what the UDEF is tied to, and now I'm not going to speak to what the ontolog forum is dealing with, but they can accommodate the different rules. In terms of verbs, the UDEF, you know, all verbs are types of, you know, processes, if you will. In other words, you know, there's action, you know, associated with processes. So, and one of the objects of the UDEF is process. So that's where you would find various verbs.
Yeah, let me just. I'm not 100% convinced that the problem you raised is a problem of semantic differences at all. I mean, you know, in an order, I may want to have order schemas built so that I can say, or shipping, ASM schemas built so that I can say, this shipping notice actually covers several orders. But I'm not changing the meaning of order or notice, or none of those things change in meaning, right? You're gonna have that.
Use that.
So it is a semantic. I think it's a syntax.
Yeah, we should.
Well, the syntax varies depending upon the content.
Before we go in, let's agree what we're all talking about with syntax first, but defer to the ontological expert first.
Okay. So for me, syntax is a particular sequence of characters. So there's an XML syntax, there's SQL syntax, there's, you know, at the bottom level, there's ASCII syntax. and these are issues of how we put characters together, and there's a relationship between syntax and semantics, often for particular languages that address semantics, but they are different things. So XML, for example, says absolutely nothing about semantics. It is only a standard for syntax. SQL says a little tiny bit about semantics, because it does say, you know, includes, you know, this query language that actually pulls a little bit of meaning out of the statement. And something like first order logic, you know, there's a semantics for first order logic, for what it means to be there exists, or for all, or and, or not, or implied. Those are the standard elements of the first order logical language. But there's, you know, a host of various syntax that first-order logic can appear in, including XML syntax. So I've created an XML DTD that defines an XML rendering of first-order logic. But it's the logic that has the semantics, not the XML, just the syntax. So forgive me for that tutorial.
I think she's saying
XML schema doesn't address semantics either.
Right, but I think she's saying that the semantics of the document varies depending upon the context.
Yes.
So it can have different number of elements.
I buy into that.
A purchase order can mean different things in different contexts.
Yep.
I thought that's what Duane was getting at. And I thought I think there's synergy between what you're doing and what Duane is doing, because the rules for the context dependency can be specified.
Right, and I think
that's what Steve is saying.
Yeah, and I think the problem, in fact, you're addressing is you've got both problems. I mean, there's a syntax, or there's a sort of data arrangement problem that is, in some sense, incidental or accidental
And then there's a probably some deep deep semantic issues between, you know, one SAP's implementation of an order reconciliation by handling system and another, you know, rendering or implementation in SAP.
I'm listening.
And the answer is yes, we do.
I think really we need to sit down with this group and more people for a couple days.
I have to correct one thing for the record. Just to correct both what Adam said and what Dwayne said. It's not true that XML has no syntax, semantics, and it's not true that schema has no semantics. It's just semantics that's different from the kind we're all talking about here. XML does say this is an element, and that's
true.
An attribute, and this is a delimiter.
So right? We've got a line on what we mean by semantics.
It's at a different level.
Well,
and that was actually the thing that got me to stand up, because I disagree slightly with Gary, you know, not like I heard of that before. But I would tend to categorize the changes in structure that you're talking about as still being syntax. This structure versus that structure, we're still talking about syntax.
Right.
The pattern of characters that we're going to stick inside the document.
Right, this is Leo. I usually characterize the distinction between syntax and structure. Syntax is kind of like the string formation that Adam's talked about. Structure typically, so that's represented by the XML syntax, for example. But structure might be represented by XML schema, which is trying to characterize kind of aggregations of syntax, if you will. And it has nothing to do with meaning yet, but it tells you that within this column, there has to be a certain kind of thing which is characterized by a certain syntax. So structure you can view as an extension of syntax.
Right.
Exactly.
Yeah, and their dependencies or ties over to semantics for any particular system, because often the, you know, these syntactic things aren't just totally arbitrary. They're there for a reason to actually tell you something. It's just that semantics is often left implicit either in the standard or just, you know, up to the programmer and how he's actually defined how things are stored or presented.
Or somebody reads the implication into it by reading the element name.
Yeah.
And they think, oh, name, I know what that is.
Too. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, for a is there a marker?
For a computer, it's pretty easy with XML. If I was to draw this on the screen, probably no one in this room knows what that means. You can't read it. XML at least puts it into a format like this where you can say H-E-E-P. It's actually a Japanese kanji character. You still don't know what it means here, but you can read it. You can then look up through some other methods of semantics to determine it means fire. Were you right? Did you get that?
You see that on things on the street? Yeah. Let me steer this in a slightly. This discussion has been entirely too polite. I have here a question that I received in email when I sent out the notice that this thing was going to happen from a person who shall remain nameless but is fairly high up in world standards organizations, and he asks grumpily, if we have core components developed using the CCTS, why do we need UDEF?
Okay, UDEF is actually in my opinion, it's an implementation of an aspect of core component, which is a unique identifier. And UDEF does a very good job of correlating that unique identifier with something other than just it being a unique identifier. So core components has a unique identifier that we use for saying this is one core component, and whatever register you find it in, you know it's the same core component. UDEF has a way of making that, and correct me if I'm wrong, Ron, but making that unique identifier actually through a UDEF registry translate into something more than just a universal identifier. It actually can correlate or be reconciled with the qualifier terms and the actual class that it comes from.
Right. It's not just an identifier. It has internal structure, and the structure has meaning.
It's got intelligence within the ID.
But how does that
reference from the ID?
How does that? What was I cutting in for the question?
It's like the difference of the unique identifier is like just reading a word. The UDEF is like reading the word plus the dictionary meaning of the word.
Oh.
Yeah. And And I don't think any one of the things that you saw today are in itself a complete solution to the higher level problem, which is kind of what you were asking. I think that all of this is, you know, relating. It's complementary in that it's a piece of this problem. So we didn't get as ugly as the question.
I think what the questioner was. Let me rephrase that simple question and read his mind. I think what he was saying is, in a core components defined term, it's a 3-part 1-1-1-7-9 term that looks like a very verbose version, but more mnemonic version of what UDEF does with its 3-part term. So that's the comparison I would make. Now with IDs, it seems to me that we're talking about the dictionary entry name and just different ways of expressing it. Is that right? Is there something more going on there?
You can take all of what's in core components and map them all into the UDEF and give them all UDEF IDs. But the UDEF by its very nature can go far beyond what core components let it get. For example, and I'll be talking about this tomorrow, the entire Department of Defense warfighter deals with things such as getting a getting a weapon on a target by a certain time. And all of the concepts associated with that domain are things that I suspect will never show up in a core component slide.
Why? What would prevent that? What limitation of core components would prevent this?
A lot of that stuff is classified. Now, I'm not saying that it couldn't, but I'm saying that it would not normally show up in an international core components library. And so there are concepts of information that need to be shared between different systems, different applications that the UDEF can accommodate. And I'm not saying that the other, you know, that core components couldn't, but it's simply the nature of what is happening in core components being an international standard, you would not probably expect those kinds of elements to show up.
Well, that doesn't sound like a difference in mechanical ability to comprehend a certain problem space. It sounds like a difference in the intention of the people who happen to be using these two things.
I would concur with that.
Right.
The pattern for both of those things is the same, whether it's a U.S. fighter jet firing a missile that's supposed to arrive at a certain time space coordinate versus a manufacturer sending something that has to arrive at a certain time coordinate. To me, that's kind of the same base pattern.
The pattern is the same, but the terminology that ends up getting used will be somewhat different.
And a great example of why terminology needs to get separated from concept.
And they have Canadians working on core components, so that will never see U.S. military.
But just to clarify something, both of them are extensible.
Both are extensible.
Can I correct you on core components? Core components, the extension, the set of core components is extensible based on doing your ontology kind of work first to figure out if you should extend it or simply repurpose existing things. The relationship between core components and BIEs is not one of extension, it's one of constraints. So you can, at the BIE, like that would be represented by something like UBL data element, is further specialized and constrained. You can't add more things to it and open it up further. And that's largely to deal with the realities of system processing, how applications
are. Are you saying there is difference between the UDEF and core components?
Core components, as far as I know, is not based on any kind of ontology foundation.
Well, I think that's what these guys are attempting to put in place.
Right? You can definitely use multiple ontology methodologies with it, but nobody's up until now has really taken the time to really start. That's a lot of work. I mean, you have to appreciate the enormous complexity that could be present. Imagine if you only had 18 base core component types and you had 8 context categories and combinations of those, and each of those had, say, maybe only 100 different enumerated lists. If you take that and look at 10^8 for each one of those 18 core components, you're dealing with a huge chunk of information. And then the relationships between all of those, this is derived from this only in this specific set of contextual circumstances. You know, it's kind of not surprising that the work hasn't been done yet.
You know, one thing I really like about the CCT, though, is that they really have, it seems to me, made an effort to be general and minimal and not add things kind of willy-nilly, which I think is that there's a real problem in any kind of, you know, it's both a problem with formal ontology as well as any other standard where people say, you know, there's a problem with people not going into doing that real deep level analysis, especially with regards to that three-part diagram of ontology versus language versus knowledge, where especially people say, you know, I have 2 different words for the same thing. They must just be different concepts. Let's put them both in the standard. Without doing the deeper analysis that actually finds out there's really a third concept that is the unifier of the two of them. And these are minor specializations of them. And that is the kind of, I think, beauty of what at least was intended with CCP,
yeah.
And what we're trying to stick with the same spirit in doing SUMO and doing the CCP mapping to SUMO, is not creating new things unless we've done the deep analysis to realize that that new concept absolutely deserves its right to be included in its distinct and its expressible explicitly how it's distinct from all of the other terms that already exist.
I'll give you examples of this in theory of 2 different groups doing the same thing, and one taking a more pragmatic approach to doing that hard analysis of stuff. The SIPSON IJI data dictionary has 353 data elements. Of those, you probably could argue that they all map roughly to those top 20 representation types. The U.S. Department of Justice has one with almost 5,000 data elements, and a lot of those are the same 4 qualifier terms, but with a 5th qualifier that's only marginally different at the front. And when you get, you know, with anything, when you get to over a couple hundred of these, you end up to the point where it becomes largely difficult to manage just by the sheer number you're looking at, and if you don't have them organized into some sort of structured hierarchy and have agreed upon the methodology for how you stuff things in those different levels of the hierarchy and the rules that constrain that, so 2 people doing the same thing arrive at the same conclusion, it's not going to be easy to do the work. And that's what I think the benefit of that. Kind of
so, I mean, SUMO is one ontological system, right? I mean, there's other systems. Now, there you can create mapping between one system to another. So theoretically speaking, there's only 1 true ontological system. I mean, should cover the whole, you know, reality, cover deep in some reality, so there should be only 1 ontological system.
Well, so one thing I like to, you know, this is a terrible argument, okay? Let me rephrase that. This is a difficult argument because people want to say, you know, my worldview is actually different. I think on some level you're absolutely right that there is sort of 1, you know, true ontology somewhere, but we're not really going to find out what it is. And what I like to say is that SUMO is sort of 1 of many true upper ontologies that could be created. Okay, there are others. There are others. Several groups are doing different ontologies. They're all sufficient because at the high level we're talking about metaphysics. We're talking about things philosophers have argued over for thousands of years without conclusion. Now, we have to be sure we don't repeat mistakes that were then solved later in philosophy. But there's no hard and fast grounding, for example, on whether entities have identity over time or whether there's no such thing as change and there's merely relations between temporal slices of things over time. The classic 2D versus the 4D argument. I'm happy to go through all the painful details of that offline, but just suffice it to say this is an argument that's still going on in metaphysics. It will probably go on for the next 100, if not 1,000 years. There's no right answer to it. There's merely an internally self-consistent model, just in the same way that, you know, particle physics is modeling things for, I think, which will ultimately decide there's no objective reality. There are merely our self-consistent models that have predictive power, and that's what we're after, something that has utility, it has predictive power, and no one's saying that, you know, I'm not saying that SUMO is the 1 true model, and all the terms that I have are an objective reflection of reality. They are a model that has predictive power.
Right, but to ratchet that down several levels, but arrive at a similar problem. It only recently came up in UBL discussions, in discussions about what does CCTS conformance mean, that we had to say, well, something can be perfectly CCTS conformant and yet, at the end of the day, result in a set of core components that is not the same as a set of core components that's being standardized, say, in CFAC. So it's entirely possible you have a totally CCTS compliant standard whose core components bore only, you know, very little resemblance to the core components that you're going to get out of a different effort that thinks it's analyzing the same problem space.
It's the context of which you do the work.
Yeah, but it reminds me on a different level of the point Adam was making. In other words, we don't know. I mean, the quest for the one true semantic registry, if you back away far enough from it, doesn't look that different from the quest of the one true upper ontology. Right, the one's a lot more complex and is taking place at a different level. But
and pragmatically, I would suggest we probably won't get there in our lifetime because we can't even agree on what side of the road to drive on, what the plug, what the electrical outlet in a wall should look like, or what the phone jack should
not
look like.
Not a difference
like.
In concept.
Yeah,
can I just bring up? You brought up the
shop for a second, otherwise the plan will make sense. The other thing I think from the whole idea of business standardization and communication. Is that there are kind of two things that are going on when we define the semantics richly and explicitly. One of which I'm not quite convinced of yet, because it goes back to John, your have the system tell me where the perfect hamburger is analogy. And that is the ability for the system to go in and axiomatically look, take a look at all these rules, do the inference, and come up with conclusions. That's a type of behavior I'm not quite convinced we're going to see a lot of value out of short term, except in very isolated systems and applications. The other thing that's going on, however, is that having these incredibly precise definitions allow us to be confident that this concept and this concept are different, and the terms we apply to them are, we can make sure they're distinct and we don't stomp all over each other. So it's for those of us who interact with the model to know that we're really dealing with something fairly concrete that's distinct from something else, and those definitions allow us to make those determinations with some level of reliability. Now, if we can go to the next step, and those definitions are truthful in the big world sense, and the machines can now make reasonable inferences about things and drive conclusions we might not have been able to do otherwise or faster or whatever. That's an additional set of benefits, but it's an entirely different behavioral space.
Who was that just talking?
That was Kurt Conrad.
Ah, okay.
So just, Duane, you just brought, I think, alluded to a really interesting issue, which is about maintenance of standards. And so I look at, you know, the DoD data model. Which is something defined in IDAP, and it's just, you know, enormous and has just tremendous redundancy. And why does it have redundancy? It has redundancy because everybody was supposed to put their stuff into this data model, but it was really hard to find where to connect it. So they just threw things in, and there was no way to have an automated process to determine whether that thing was contradictory or redundant. As I think the standards community moves to a greater degree of formalization, computability in the standards, so standards that are not defined on the basis of language, but standards that are defined on the basis of logic, then we'll have the ability, at least in theory, to prove whether my new concept with its associated axiom actually extends the model or is just redundant or is just contradictory. We have the ability to give some of this terrible maintenance problem to the machines and have them do it automatically, as opposed to having a person reading pages and pages of the dictionary and saying, well, you know, your English definition is kind of like this English definition, therefore I think these two things should be merged.
I would ditto and say, yay verily, and suggest to you that that's, in essence, what the UDEF registry would do as well.
Well, but the assignment both UDEF and CCTS, and both UDEF and core components are similar in this respect, and very different from what I'm hearing about ontologies, okay, is that they are, even though they have this classification system in both cases, this 11179-derived classification system, what you get out of it at the end of the exercise are the fruits of human beings sitting down and saying, you know, this really is the same thing as that, okay, or this falls into this category, whereas presumably what I could get, I mean, some of that goes on at certain reaches of the ontology, but I could get new statements that didn't rely upon human judgment that this is in a certain relationship to that.
I mean,
right, based on the rules that are baked into these things.
Let me elaborate on that a second. Part of what CCTS does deliver is that the first part of the work, as you know, you were there, was the methodology for how you analyze those things and make those decisions. And that could be instantiated by humans, or it could be instantiated by applications eventually if you had enough machine-processable artifacts to have to support that process. But for now, it's largely a human process where, you know, and the value of CCTS, I don't think, is truly the output or what potential output could be if they went and did output right now, but it's really the thinking that went into that process that enabled people like the UBL group to come along and actually apply that and derive at that output. Because if that process is reused, hopefully the next people who come along will be guided towards the same kind of methodology.
Well, yes, but in just to be clear about this, that is not actually what's happening. It's happening the other way around. What's actually happening is that people do all this definition and then they say, oh, can we abstract out of here some core components?
In theory, if it happens.
In theory, that's right.
And that would be the third part of what Adam said to you. It'd be nice to define standards. And the other thing is that I would add is without politics. That
I can't promise a solution to that.
I think the point here, this is Steve Ray again, is that the point of ontologies is when you can axiomatize them, you boil them down to a fairly small number of axioms. And what an axiom is an act of faith, right? I mean, you just have to take that definition on faith. And those are the things, presumably, these definitions are definitions that are virtually impossible to misunderstand. And that's where I was getting at with some of these other definitions, which are much higher level. They're still very possible to misunderstand. But I think if you can axiomatize the definitions, then you can stick to a fairly, you know, atomic definitions, and then you can build on those to determine what's different and what's the same.
Steve, while you're on the phone, Steve is the chief from NIST on manufacturing system integration. I think if you can give us a rendering of your semantic distance approach to standards, I mean, that might illuminate the subject, especially answer one of the questions an earlier person asked about where's the big picture, where do we stand? I mean,
yeah, actually, semantic distance is a big unanswered issue right now. We don't really have a good way of measuring semantic distance. All we can say with logic is that something is either equal or not equal, or consistent or inconsistent, but what we have been trying to struggle with is how would one go about quantifying how far apart two definitions are from each other, semantic concepts. That's a huge question. We had a workshop on it. We're still trying to struggle with what even branch of mathematics could even lend to that, but I think that's still a deep research issue which is not going to see the light of sort of practical application for many years to come, I think.
Actually, Steve, we did some of that in the HPKV project.
Uh-huh.
You know, I'm not claiming in any sense that we have the answer, but we did have a measure for semantic distance, and with a large formal ontology, it's fairly easy to come up with several.
Huh. I'd love to talk to you more about that.
Yeah, definitely. Let's do that.
Even within the CCTS and the UDEF would support this, there is a you could look at the number of alignment of qualifier terms versus the disalignment and come up with some rudimentary, you know, applied.
Yeah,
I
think there are symptomatic correlations. You could talk about, you know, jumps in WordNet, you know, how far away you are or something.
Right.
But ultimately, we're trying to pursue. This is a personal passion of mine, which is, I think we need to approach this whole field like an engineer who's designing a bridge. And if we're trying to design a model, an ontology, whatever, we need to use, you know, proven principles. We need to have quantifiable and measurable units to help us understand if something's correct. That's why I like the first order logic approach, because you can prove consistency. It's not an opinion anymore. It's this model is self-consistent or it isn't, because you can run a theorem prover over it and uncover the inconsistencies. And I think it's building blocks like that, you know, robust, provably complete, axiomatized ontologies that are going to be the building blocks that we build much more elaborate constructs out of down the road. And for ever, basically, since IT was invented, we've been doing this kind of top-down because that's all we have. We don't have a science of meaning that is operationalized yet to build these automated systems. So we have to do, you know, data modeling with opinions as to what a thing means, and we rely upon the internalization of that in our own minds to carry us through the sort of the leaps of faith that we have to make right now. So this is a, you know, a long-term effort, though. We have to sort of go back to first principles, I think, treat the building of these systems like an engineering discipline, and then we'll have predictability, you know, predictable behavior of these systems, as opposed to software that one builds and ends up with, you know, bugs, which we then fix after the fact because, you know, we don't anticipate them ahead of time. And the analogies, you know, there are many analogies, civil engineering, whatever. You don't build a bridge and then sort of see if it holds the truck and then fix it if it doesn't. You can predict how much load the bridge is going to support because we have an underlying science of stress and failure analysis and things like that.
I would assert with, I would love to follow up on that myself. I think some of us are just getting warmed up.
Yeah.
but we have hit the time with, that we scheduled for this. So thank you all. This is lovely. Perhaps we can schedule something similar again and continue this discussion. I think it is. I think in EIDX we're talking about a field of application that really does practically need answers to these questions. These are not theoretical to us.
Yeah.
As was brought up by some of the questions here, the idea of how much distance there is semantically between what appear to be related or similar concepts is a critical question, especially in our field when we get into the legal implications of what's being said. And then we need to know, did what you say over here mean the same thing as what I thought you meant?
Yeah. Okay.
So on that note, I thank our panelists and our participants. Peter, you were saying that this has been recorded and will be available. Is that right? Could you tell us a little bit about that?
All right. I actually set up a wiki page on the Ontolog forum space. That people, remote callers, probably had already accessed that page to get the numbers and download the slides. But whoever is interested can go to that page. We have recorded this, so maybe by tonight I'll be able to upload an MP3 file of the recording of this session. It's also available for telephone replay over the next 10 days in case you want to hear this over again. There's a number you can dial in to play this back.
Okay, great. The next EIDX meeting is going to be in Houston in April. I don't have those dates right in front of me, but maybe we can maybe you can consider offline whether you folks might be available to continue this discussion.
I mean,
sure.
Up to. And,
sure.
And for those who are interested in the discussion, this is ongoing. Our URL is ontolog.cim3.net. Come join us.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
Okay.
Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, all.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
The host has disconnected. The conference...